Middle East tensions escalate to dangerous levels.
Hell is breaking loose in Lebanon.
Ukraine's president does a diplomatic dance.
You understand that after November, we have to decide, and we hope that the strength of the United States will be very strong, and we count on it.
And the mayor of the largest city in the United States faces federal corruption charges, accusing him of accepting bribes and illegal campaign contributions from foreign nationals. Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. One day after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas urged the UN to stop the war in Gaza, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed critics in a defiant address to world leaders at the UN General Assembly Friday and vowed to continue targeting Iranian-backed Hezbollah militants in Lebanon.
I didn't intend to come here this year. My country is at war, fighting for its life. But after I heard the lies and slanders leveled at my country by many of the speakers at this podium, I decided to come here and set the record straight.
Israel has dramatically escalated strikes, saying it's targeting Hezbollah's military capacities and senior Hezbollah commanders, and vowing it will no longer tolerate incoming daily rocket fire.
And we'll continue degrading Hezbollah until all our objectives are met.
Shortly after Netanyahu spoke, the Israel Defense Forces hit what they said is Hezbollah's headquarters in Beirut's southern suburbs. His leadership mired in conflicts on two fronts, Netanyahu's comments dimmed hopes for an internationally backed ceasefire. Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem joins us for some perspective on the timing and motivation of the prime minister's strategy.
There's a lot of speculation that maybe nothing is going to happen until both sides see what happens in the November U.S. presidential election.
Right. I mean, that's what, you know, some people have said, that Netanyahu is waiting, and that if the former President Trump wins, he will see that as an advantage for Israel and feel that he can, then move ahead. It's certainly a possibility. Look, I think, you know, Netanyahu also has his own political considerations. He is afraid that if there's a ceasefire in Gaza and the war ends, that Israel will go to new elections that he would not win. So he has been kind of delaying any kind of a ceasefire because of that. He doesn't want his coalition to fall apart. The right wing of his coalition has said that they will vote against a ceasefire in Gaza as well as any ceasefire in Lebanon. At the same time, I think there's a sense that nobody, whether it's Hezbollah, whether it's Lebanon, whether it's Israel, that nobody really wants another war. Hezbollah has very significant military capabilities, and if it becomes an all-out war with Israeli ground troops moving in, I think it's likely that there are going to be a lot of casualties on both sides. And I think that there's this sense that both Israel and Hezbollah are keeping just short of a full-scale war. Israel's not hitting Lebanese targets like infrastructure, power plants, things like that. Hezbollah has stepped up its rocket strikes on civilian areas, but except for one long-range missile, it has not struck Tel Aviv or the center of the country. So they're both kind of playing this game where they're upping the ante without going to a full-scale war.
How is the general population in Israel, and of course the families of the hostages, how are they feeling about this new military operation, as they've been for months calling for the priority to be a ceasefire in Gaza? We're not hearing much about that now.
Well, certainly the hostage families have been very vocal, and they're very concerned that, you know, Israel's focus will switch to the north and that the 101 hostages in Gaza probably fewer than half of which are alive, will be forgotten. And so they're trying to do all kinds of activities and press conferences and, you know, to say to people, wait, you know, we've still got these hostages in Gaza. I think that at the same time, the Israeli public is supportive of an operation in Lebanon because there are, you know, 63,000 Israelis who left their homes, you know, in the days after October 7th, when Hezbollah started firing on Israel, and haven't been able to go back, as opposed to Gaza, when many of the people, especially in the cities near Gaza, have been able to move back to their homes. And except in some of the kibbutzim that were really destroyed, they now have alternative solutions. But the people in the north, they feel that the government has kind of abandoned them. So they feel that it's, you know, finally the government is paying some attention to them. And I think that, you know, a lot of Israelis feel the situation in which Hezbollah can just fire randomly whenever it wants on northern Israel is not acceptable, and that people should be allowed to move back to their homes. I mean, Israel has no territorial ambitions in Lebanon. It just wants the UN Resolution 1701, which calls for Hezbollah to move north of the Litani River. It just wants, which is about 13 miles from the border, it just wants that enforced.
Linda Gradstein, coming to us from Jerusalem, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
And there are still growing concerns that further escalation in Lebanon could spiral into an all-out regional war. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
An all-out war must be avoided at all costs. It would surely be an all-out catastrophe. The people of Lebanon, as well as the people of Israel and the people of the world, cannot afford Lebanon to become another Gaza.
Speaking to reporters on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly Friday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington has made it clear it believes the way forward is through diplomacy, not conflict.
The path to diplomacy may seem difficult to see at this moment, but it is there, and in our judgment, it is necessary. And we will continue to work intensely with all parties to urge them to choose that course.
He said the choices that all parties in the Middle East make in the coming days will determine which path the region takes and have profound consequences for years to come. Over 700 people have been killed in Lebanon this week, according to Lebanon's health ministry. I spoke with Bashir Ayoub, Oxfam's Lebanon country director, who says this latest emergency is deepening the existing challenges of the people in Lebanon.
Basically, what is happening on the ground is a third of the country is basically too dangerous to access. So even if you had the intention to deliver aid or reach the communities that are in need, the Bekaa Valley in its entirety is extremely dangerous right now for movements, and the majority of the south of Lebanon is extremely, extremely dangerous. The strikes tend to be moving further north, and it's a little bit difficult to kind of guess where the next strike might happen. The biggest issue that we have had is the displaced populations that are moving in from the south. We got anecdotal information that some people started moving at 11 a.m. and they reached their final destination at 3 in the morning. There were hundreds of thousands of cars on the road, and there was also reported strikes on the road while they were moving. So currently, you have a lot of public schools and public buildings that are housing the displaced population. Some Lebanese people have also opened their homes. We have to obviously have that in the context of a country that is in a full-fledged economic collapse, and people don't necessarily have the means to support their own families, but they have opened up their homes in order to help. And a lot of local organizations and international organizations like ourselves have been on the ground. So schools have closed. A lot of businesses have recommended that people do stay home. So earlier on, when the offensive first happened, the roads were completely packed throughout Lebanon just for people moving to safer locations. Since then, you have areas that are not directly impacted by sustained attacks. You can kind of see some sense of normalcy, but for areas like large cities in South Lebanon, the Bekaa, they've basically been turned into ghost towns. From what we've been able to see, there is considerable destruction, and both to buildings and roads and basically anything you can imagine that's within the blast radius.
How serious of a situation is this becoming for the civilian population?
So even if you were to remove all of the other complexities and crises that the country was going through, it's a fairly severe crisis right now. If we're only focusing on the displaced populations and we're not looking at the strikes themselves. So the expectation, because the closest reference point we have to what's currently going on is the 2006 war. The estimated number of the displaced population then that moved within 48 hours was close to 950,000. We still haven't received official numbers of how many displaced people have moved from the south in some areas of the Bekaa, but I can easily see those numbers being reached by the end of the week, if not eclipsed. That's on one front. The second part is the casualties that unfortunately either were injured or passed away. It's the halfway mark or the halfway number of the entire 33-day war in 2006. So in terms of severity and in terms of how the country is able to cope with this type of crisis, like I mentioned earlier, there's an economic collapse. Our government is a caretaker government, so it kind of handcuffs them with what they're able to do and not do. They are responding to the best of their abilities, but there's very limited resources right now for everybody to respond in the manner that they would hope. The call for a ceasefire in Gaza, this has been by all parties, at least within Lebanon, have said if there's a ceasefire in Gaza, there will be a ceasefire in Lebanon, like all hostilities will end. So that is what is being discussed, and we clearly see that there's a correlation to it. There is a very clear link. It is taking on more of a regional scope, and you know, this is a region that since many decades has struggled. Since the Beirut port explosion that took place a few years ago, we've been on a downward trajectory as an entire country. So whether that's services that were usually provided, the collapsing of the banking sector, the rapid devaluation of the currency and people saw their savings evaporate, that already took its toll on the population. And obviously, because of our history, we know that we live in a fairly volatile region. So there's definitely, we are extremely concerned about being able to provide life-saving interventions for those that are most affected. But I think if you look at the country as a whole, it's taken a massive, 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 massive toll on everyone's mental health and how much they can continue to cope. Lebanon was already in extremely terrible shape, and that's why, as Oxfam, as an organization, we really are pushing for a ceasefire and a cessation of hostilities, because we fully recognize that this isn't a country that can continue to cope with multiple crises. They're now only being separated by a few months. They're no longer, you know, once every decade you'll have an event. For the past 3-4 years, it's been unrelenting crisis after crisis in Lebanon, and it's definitely taken its toll on the population. And if we're in a prolonged war, you can only imagine the impact that'll have on Lebanon as a country.
Oxfam Lebanon Country Director Bashir Ayoub, thank you so much for being with us. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Turning to the other major conflict dominating the focus of world leaders at the UN General Assembly this week, Russia's continued invasion of Ukraine. Former President Donald Trump met Friday with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in New York, where Trump repeated his claims that he would be able to end the war in Ukraine by making a deal with Russia. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this report.
Emergency crews were still cleaning up after an overnight Russian attack in Zaporizhia, Ukraine, when Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met with former President Donald Trump in New York Friday. In response to VOA's question, Trump repeated his claim he will quickly end the war in Ukraine if elected.
I have a very good relationship, and I also have a very good relationship, as you know, with President Putin. And I think if we win, I think we're going to get it resolved very quickly.
Zelensky admitted he cannot win against Russia before the U.S. presidential election in November.
We understand that after November, we have to decide, and we hope that the strength of the United States will be very strong, and we count on it. That's why I decided to meet with both candidates with all honor to them.
Zelensky met with Vice President Kamala Harris, the Democratic presidential nominee, in Washington Thursday. Unlike Trump, who is pushing for Kyiv to strike a deal with Moscow, she underscored that it is up to Ukraine to decide how the war will end.
I will continue to stand with Ukraine, and I will work to ensure Ukraine prevails in this war.
Without mentioning names, Harris criticized Trump, who often boasts of his relations with Putin, by saying that calls for Ukraine to end the war by ceding territory to Russia were, quote, dangerous and unacceptable. Tensions have been brewing between Trump and Zelensky after the Ukrainian president recently rebuked Trump's claims he can quickly end the war.
the president of Ukraine is in our country, and he's making little nasty aspersions toward your favorite president, me.
Earlier this week, Trump blamed Zelensky and the Biden administration for prolonging the war that followed Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, saying the United States could have made a deal instead of supporting Ukraine with weapons. Trump's claims created further anxiety not only in Kyiv, but also in some European capitals. Ian Lesser, distinguished fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, via Skype.
We're very attuned to signs that somehow Washington will take a very different tack when it comes to policy on Ukraine and when it comes to how hard a stance to take with Moscow.
Republicans are also angry over Zelensky's visit to an ammunition factory in Pennsylvania, a hotly contested battleground state in the November U.S. presidential election. They alleged it was a, quote, campaign event designed to help Democrats that amounts to election interference by Kyiv. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
I spoke with former U.S. Ambassador to NATO and current distinguished fellow with the Center for European Policy Analysis, Kurt Volker, for his take on Zelensky's address to the General Assembly, which included a plan for peace.
The whole reason for this victory plan was to basically try to address the critique coming from Washington and to some degree from Berlin, you know, arguing why they're asking for long-range weapons. Said, well, you don't really need those. You know, the Russians already moved the aircraft. You're not going to hit anything with those. And you know, it's escalatory. It runs the risk of widening the conflict and so on. So Zelensky wanted to put together a plan and say, look, you know, it's part of a strategy. You know, we actually have to win here. And here are the things that we need to do. And long-range weaponry is part of that. I don't think there was anything terribly new in any of these arguments. And as a result, I don't think the White House really changed their view in any way. I suppose if they were going to allow Ukraine to fire long range, they wouldn't make a big announcement about it anyway. They would probably just quietly lift restrictions and probably on a case-by-case basis.
In your view, would these longer range missiles that are able to strike targets deeper into Russia, do you think that they would deter or just stir things up and make them worse?
Well, I think they would have an operational impact. So they would be able to hit fuel depots, ammunition depots. They would force the Russians to have more emphasis on protecting their own forces. So they would not be in as aggressive a posture. They'd have to be deploying aircraft from further back. So it would have a lot of operational implications. It would be beneficial.
And then, of course, we do have this election looming that Donald Trump could return to the White House. There's a lot of consternation about that and concern from Zelensky that the U.S. support could go away. He's meeting with Donald Trump.
No, I think that's good. I think it's especially after going to visit that ammunition plant in Scranton. It's good that he actually spent some time with Trump. And I think the overlay that I was thinking of is the Biden administration is concerned that Trump is arguing that the administration is risking getting us into World War III. And so they are therefore wanting to be cautious about any kind of announcements about long-range weaponry. That's where I was going with that. But in terms of the election itself, Trump has been seemingly in the last week or so drifting more and more towards a position of just saying cut off aid to Ukraine. He said, you may have seen, I saw it in a video clip, that Ukraine is lost. They've lost this territory. They lost so many lives. They should have taken a deal. They didn't. That's where he seems to be drifting to. It's not true. It was just in Ukraine last week. It's not lost.
I think he said it was dead.
Yeah, it's dead. It's not dead. It's incredibly dynamic. There's more traffic jams in Kyiv than there are in Washington.
Volodymyr Zelensky said at the UN Security Council this week that Russia can only be forced into peace. I wonder what you think that means.
Well, I think Zelensky's right about that. What I think that means is that Putin launched this war as an act of will. He wanted to do it. Until he stopped, he's going to keep going. So you need to actually have countervailing force to stop him, to force him to then negotiate a conclusion to the war. But until then, he's going to keep fighting and keep attacking.
Again, back to the former president who could potentially be the next president again. You know, he says Ukraine just needs to make a deal. They just basically meaning that Ukraine should give up part of its territory, and they're not going to do that.
Well, even if they did, it wouldn't necessarily stop the war. That's the point, is that even if you gave Russia territory, does that mean they're going to stop? They have maximalist objectives of taking over the whole country.
Right. It would seem like also they may have ambitions beyond Ukraine if they were to actually...
If they got away with it, yeah. Right. They would certainly be looking at the Baltic states and maybe part of Poland and say, you know, these all used to belong to Russia. They should again.
Former U.S. Ambassador to NATO and current Distinguished Fellow with the Center for European Policy Analysis, Kurt Volker. And finally, political turmoil as the leader of the largest city in the United States faces federal corruption charges. Aaron Reinen has the story from the Big Apple.
In a stunning development, New York City Mayor Eric Adams has been indicted on multiple charges, including campaign finance violations, bribery, and conspiracy, sending shockwaves through the city and the political landscape nationally. Damian Williams is United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York.
Today we are announcing campaign finance, bribery, and conspiracy charges against Eric Adams, the mayor of New York City. Mayor Adams engaged in a long-running conspiracy in which he solicited and knowingly accepted illegal campaign contributions from foreign donors and corporations.
Prosecutors argue that the mayor received money from a Turkish government official and Turkish businessmen who are attempting to buy influence. Damian Williams again.
We also allege that the mayor sought and accepted well over $100,000 in luxury travel benefits from some of the same foreign actors who arranged many of the illegal campaign contributions.
Mayor Adams refutes these charges.
This did not surprise us that we reached this day. And I ask New Yorkers to wait to hear our defense before making any judgments. Based on what I read, it's clear that if there's campaign violations, I know I don't violate the campaign.
That's right.
If it's foreign donors, I know I don't take money from foreign donors.
Adams insisted that his day-to-day responsibilities as mayor will remain unchanged.
From here, my attorneys will take care of the case so I can take care of the city. My day-to-day will not change. I will continue to do the job for 8.3 million New Yorkers that I was elected to do.
New Yorkers responded to the news with a range of opinions.
I think it's terrible. I think the city deserves much better, and they all have to go, the whole Adams crew.
I don't think taking campaign funds, if he did, sure, he should get in trouble, but I'm not convinced this means he needs to step down.
Former federal prosecutor Nima Romani says these charges are historic.
This is a historic indictment. The first time a sitting mayor has been charged in the city of New York. And this is something that the feds don't take lightly. You can't get approval to charge an elected official until you go all the way up the ranks of the Department of Justice.
Romani also notes that the charges could result in a lengthy prison sentence.
Adams is looking up to 45 years in federal prison, the most serious counts of which are the wire fraud, which carry a 20-year max. And because of the amount of the fraud, which is millions of dollars, under the guidelines, he's looking at years in prison, even if he doesn't get the max.
As Mayor Adams continues to serve, the political and legal drama is likely to escalate, with many waiting to see how the defense will unfold and what effect this case will have on the future of New York City governance. Aaron Reinen, VOA News, New York City.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.